Well, it's time to go.
Yeah, I guess. Oh, geez. Hello. I guess we'll start. Fine.
Yeah, sorry, I wasn't ready.
Hey, everybody, I'm Kyle Rizdahl. Welcome back to Make Me Smart. Making today make sense is what we do.
And I'm Kimberly Adams. Thank you for joining us for What Do You Want to Know Wednesday? And that means it's time for all of us to get smarter by way of answering your questions.
If you've got one, by the way, a question that is, that you'd like us to find the answer to, or that we just happen to know off the top of our heads, you know what to do. Email us, makemesmart@marketplace.org, or leave us a voicemail. Our number is 508-UB-SMART.
Okay, first question of the day.
Hi, this is Clay from San Francisco. I was wondering what regular consumers like me can do to help the economy and improve the current inflation situation. Thanks for making me smart.
It's a good question.
So nice, Clay.
Here's the answer, Clay. Stop spending money. Do nothing. Buy nothing. Buy food and gas. Maybe clothes if you need to. But otherwise, don't spend anything. Here's the deal, right? Inflation is too much money chasing too few goods, fundamentally. And what we have in this economy right now is consumers still 2 years on with pent-up demand from the pandemic and not enough goods, whether that's gas or refrigerators or couches or whatever, right? And that's why the Federal Reserve raised interest rates today, right? The federal funds rate up 75 basis points, 0.75%. The Federal Reserve is trying to convince you not to spend money. It wants people to say, ooh, let's put this in the bank, or let's put it under our mattresses, or let's just hang out for a little while. And it wants companies to say, you know what? It's too expensive now to borrow and invest in new equipment or what have you. Consumers right now are driving a huge part of the inflation in this economy. So if individuals, consumers would stop spending, that would do it. Of course, that's ridiculous, but that's what it would take.
I mean, yeah. So it also helps the environment. Don't buy stuff you don't need.
Yes, that is true. Don't buy what you don't need. Yes. All right. Next question. Here we go.
Hi, my name is Roger. Longtime listener, first time caller. I wonder if you guys can help make me smart by answering how rent control works.
Oh,
wow. Yes. The thing that many, many people wish they had about now. Rent control is a broad term used to describe government programs that limit how quickly or how much your landlord can raise your rent, right? This is the intention there is to keep housing costs affordable, particularly in places where rents are really volatile or where, you know, there's risk of gentrification. So, for example, if you live in California, in a city that doesn't have its own rent control rules, rent increases will be limited to 5% plus local inflation, but could never exceed a total of 10%. But it's not super common in the U.S., I mean, you've probably heard stories of people who got these super cheap pandemic rents and then, like, when it came time to renew, the rent, like, doubled or went up by 50% or something like that. Mm-hmm. According to a 2019 study by the Urban Institute, and remember, this is pre-pandemic, 182 municipalities in the U.S. have rent control regulations. All of them are in New York, New Jersey, California, Maryland, or here in Washington, D.C. It's a controversial thing because a lot of states have banned these rent control laws, and a lot of landlords obviously hate them because they say that it keeps, you know, the rental supply low because it encourages landlords to get out of the rental market and convert their properties to condos or commercial use. Obviously, proponents of rent control think it helps control rental prices in city where the rents rise faster than wages. I mean, here in D.C., it's really hard for people to live in this city and work if you're not making, you know, way more than the median income. And so, you know, there are plenty of people who would love to have rent control. It's not super common. And there is a hefty lobbying effort by landlords and many companies to not have it be more common.
Yeah, it's super contentious, super contentious. But it's, yeah, it's a thing. And, you know, renters like it and landlords don't. And that's why it's so controversial.
Indeed.
You know, yeah.
All right. Next up is a question about private equity, which also sometimes ends up in the rental market.
Hi, my name is Ian from Atlanta. I work for a company that recently was invested in by a private equity firm. and I was wondering what that really equates to. If you could just give me a broad 30,000 foot view and maybe get into the weeds on it a little bit and make me smart. Thanks. Big fan.
Now you know we love the weeds.
Yeah, that's right. So private equity is basically companies that gather money from lots of stakeholders, right? Pension funds, endowments, college endowments, rich people, you name it. Lots of people contribute to private equity. And what private equity does is buy companies and then, generally speaking, try to turn them around and take them public, sell them to someone else, and profit by it. Here's the catch, though, and maybe the best example of this in the last like 5-8 years is Toys R Us. A private equity firm bought Toys R Us and then loaded it up with debt, right? Mm-hmm. And also trimmed down the company, fired people, cut stores, this and that, and then unloaded it, trying to make a huge profit. The catch, of course, is that those companies then are challenged with the debt load. People lose their jobs, and private equity mm-hmm. can be really destructive in that sense, right? Because private equity is out for private equity. If you're a publicly traded company, nominally you have an obligation to all the stakeholders, right? Not just shareholders, but employees and ESG and all the rest of them. Private equity becomes really challenging when they do that thing that private equity does, which is buy companies, load them up with debt, strip them down, and try to sell them off. It's interesting that Ian was talking about being invested in by private equity as opposed to being bought by private equity. I mean, private equity companies do just make general investments, right? They just do, you know, they got lots of money, and so they need to find a place to put it to work. What I'm speaking specifically about is private equity companies buying controlling interests, which can be two-edged sword, I guess, is the answer.
Do you think that private equity buyouts or investments are going to become more common in a high interest rate environment where it's harder for businesses or more expensive for businesses to get loans?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think, you know, it obviously depends on the terms of any individual deal. I would also point out, and this is a little just recent historical trivia which becomes relevant. The federal funds rate today, which is the interest rate that the Federal Reserve controls, was increased by 0.75 percentage point, as I said. It now sits, they do it in a range of 1.5% to 1.75% is what the Fed says, right? And then they conduct open market operations. They buy and sell bonds to make that work. But the federal funds rate sits right now exactly where it was in October of 2019, which is the most recent rate moving meeting of the Federal Reserve, right? So right now, everybody's like, oh my God, it's at 1.5%. That's crazy. It's exactly where it was in the before times. Right? Is it going up? Yes, some, but it's not even remotely outrageously high right now. So I think everybody needs to take a deep breath. Might PE deals thrive somehow this year? Sure, totally could. Who knows?
That's interesting. Before we go on to the next one, you know, another place where private equity is huge. It's probably the reason why many of our listeners no longer have a local newspaper.
Private
equity companies have been buying up tons of local newspapers and just like decimating the newsrooms, turning them into like content farms and chasing out all the journalists. It's quite sad.
Yeah, Alden Capital, I believe. Hang on one second.
That's the big one that a lot of people know.
Alden Global Capital.
Well, not that a lot of people know, but yeah.
Yeah, it bought the Mercury News, I think. It's bought a bunch of others. But yeah, that's exactly right.
I think
that's
they tried to buy the Post-Dispatch, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. I can't remember if they actually did it or not. Anyway, let's move on.
Yep. Okay, so next question. Jim in Georgia, here's what he wants to know. How much does it cost an airline to cancel a flight?
How much annoyance does it cost us?
What is the price of annoyance?
I know. What is the price of annoyance? Okay. For some background, airlines cancel flights for all kinds of reasons. Sometimes it's weather, sometimes it's mechanical issues. But a big one lately has been staffing shortages due to A, staffing shortages more broadly, not having enough employees because people can go do other things, but also because of the pandemic, people getting COVID and being sick or having to take care of family who are sick or losing a loved one, all the things. Airlines are understaffed. They remain understaffed from during the pandemic, and it's creating problems as people rush back into travel, especially as we're heading into this peak summer travel season. And so airlines are canceling routes. They're scaling back their summer flight schedules. I mean, you know, last time I was in St. Louis, I was supposed to come back a day before and they just canceled flight.
That's right.
But look, we checked in with Mark Hansen at the Institute for Transportation Studies at UC Berkeley. And he says that a rule of thumb is that a cancellation is equivalent to about 2 hours of a flight delay. And the cost of a flight delay is roughly $3,000 per hour. So, you know, that'd be $6,000. But the actual costs, you know, obviously just a rule of thumb. Actual cost, situation specific, and in some cases, airlines can reduce expenses by canceling a flight. So, for example, it may be more cost effective to cancel a flight than delay a flight because that allows other flights to move up in the queue, and the cost of the airlines includes what the airline has to pay crew members who are already in place and refunds to passengers who decide not to rebook their flight. But, you know, in some cases, it doesn't really cost them that much. I'll go back to my example. It didn't really cost Southwest anything on my end because I just got in an empty seat on a flight the next day. It's not like I got bonus points or anything. I just shifted and I was inconvenienced. But, you know, got to spend an extra day in the garden with my mom.
Yeah, I'll tell you, though, it's going to keep getting worse, actually. Through this summer, I mean, Delta's already canceled, you know, 100 flights a day for most of July and into August. It's not getting any better, that's for sure.
Did you see that story in the Journal about how Delta is restricting the amount of time people can spend in, like, their fancy lounges?
Oh, I did. Yes, I did.
Because basically people were like posting up in there for the free snacks and booze. The person running it said, "We're not WeWork."
God, jeez.
It's cracking me up.
Just puts more flights on the schedule. Look, I get it. I mean, airlines have crew problems and labor problems the same way everybody else does. I get it. But still.
Yeah, but they also regularly get bailed out by the federal government. So there's that.
Yep. True.
All right. That's it for us today. Thank you for listening. We will be back tomorrow to try to make sense of the news and hopefully make you smile.
In the meanwhile, questions, thoughts, comments, makemesmart@marketplace.org or leave us a voicemail. 508-UB-SMART is how you can do that.
Make Me Smart is produced by Marissa Cabrera. Olivia Zhao is our new intern. Ellen Rolfes writes our newsletter.
Juan Carlos Toronto engineered today. Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez are the writers, the composers of our theme music. Our senior producer is Bridget Bodner.
I love that they finally took the pronouncer off of Ellen's last name. I guess they believe they have faith in me to say it right now.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.